Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody. It is February 3rd. This is a live edition of The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins, your host. We are broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We have a very exciting show today. We have Tomas Curry is going to be on, the very interesting and a lot to talk about chef from Corsino Restaurant, but he has very interesting history. We're going to talk about Italian food. We're going to break down that very successful restaurant, one of Jason Denton's restaurants here in New York. We're also going to have the legendary Alan Benton, one of the top three or four ham curers in all America, is going to be on the show about 8 to 10 times this year. So he's going to come on and talk about traditions. And Joe, there's a big tradition happening today, an American tradition. It's a sport involved two teams playing with each other. Joe, are you there? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Could you possibly be talking about the Super Bowl?
Yes, yes.
All right.
The Ravens are playing the 49ers. What's the spread? Do you know who's favored? I think the 49ers are favored by like 3. Is that right?
That's possible. I'm always rooting for the underdog, and I'm a Baltimore native, so I'm kind of excited. So,
hey, did you put money towards the pay for steroids for Ray Lewis and the rest of the football player fund?
No, I don't. Unless some tax dollars went to that or something.
I mean, that was a really, when his bicep just exploded. That's essentially what happened. His bicep exploded. Ray Lewis. I was like, I don't know. You know, and meanwhile, like, guys are practicing kicking 85-yard field goals. I was like, I don't know. You know, if 30% of baseball players are on steroids, what do you think about football? But actually, Thomas was saying that there are allowed amounts, which does make sense because there's no way I would believe that no one's on steroids. Anyway, I wanted to make a little case, Joe, for gluttony. Is that okay?
It's your show. Go for it.
It's about pleasure, you know? It seems like the sustainable food. Well, first of all, America was settled by a bunch of very conservative religious groups who basically were so conservative and annoying, they couldn't get along with other people in Europe. So they had to jump in a boat, you know, go to some, you know, risk death. Move to some unknown land, you know, hunt to survive. You know, a lot of them died. But, I mean, this is a puritanical country. And, you know, we're always fearing consumption. You know, we don't show nudity on television. We're always guilty of waste and things like that. So, you know, and then even some of our biggest food people, like Michael Pollan, is always like, eat a lot of plants, very little meat. You know, only Marion Nestle's like, never eat more than 2,000 calories a day. And, you know, no one's ever really promoting gluttony. So today is the Super Bowl, and, you know, it is of the opinion of the main course and, you know, indirectly the Heritage Radio Network, that today is a time for feasting. You know, gluttony is okay today. You know, I think people should eat like 10 pizzas, 100 meatballs, 10 pounds of nachos. You know, in medieval times, days like the Super Bowl or festival days were a time of total friggin' gluttony. And it was a time when everything was inverted and it was acceptable to, you know, stuff your face until you vomited, and, you know, orifices, the butt, the mouth, you know, took center stage, and, you know, everything was kind of inverted. The king became the pauper. The pauper for one day became the king, you know, and it was a real time of excess. And, you know, Rabelais was the famous writer about these medieval feasts, and his main character was Gargantua, and you could just eat, and he would talk about how he peed 2,172,000 gallons of urine in 3-day period, and, you know, it was really funny. It was kind of like the comic strip for medieval people, so in Europe, in Western Europe. So today is that day, Don't listen to the anal sustainable food movement. Go all out. I think your goal should be to fill the toilet bowl at least 3 times tomorrow. That's when you know you really partied. So that's just what, you know, someone needs to say that. So here I am. The introduction is concluded, thank God. Another bad intro. Joe is probably tagging right now. But I am very excited to have Tomas Curry in the studio today. He was born in Washington, D.C., but grew up in Houston and all of its rich, you know, cuisines, Cajun, Vietnamese, Italian, and Mexican flavors. After graduating from university and working in the management consulting field in D.C. for a few years, he chose to follow his heart and pursue his passion of cooking. He moved to Florence, Italy. And he attended the Apicius International School of Hospitality. And he worked at the Hotel Raleigh Santa Croce Il Buco del Orafo. And he traveled extensively throughout Italy, so we're going to talk about that. And he has quite a number of you know, achievements in terms of restaurants. He's worked at Bar Milano, Falai, Inoteca Liquori, Avoce. He worked in Portland, Oregon, which is a total food mecca, at Lolo. And now he is the chef at Corsino. So welcome into the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
So did you learn anything in the schools in Italy, or did you learn from traveling around more?
Well, I learned from both, really. What Italy taught me and what school in Italy taught me was a philosophy about food and how to approach it. Your knife cuts, your cooking techniques, all that stuff, that's, of course, it's taught, but... You know, the way Italy kind of looks at food is so much different than the way America looks at food and the way that, you know, actually New York looks at food. I learned a certain way. I came here and I just got my butt kicked. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was doing.
So what's the difference in food? I mean, how do they view food differently and why? I would think in Italy you would have been shown almost every ingredient, and then you would have been able to come here and it would have been easier. So
right, but when I came here, I wasn't doing anything with the food. I was being told what to do with that food.
I see.
So everything that I learned, I had to kind of hold back a little bit and say, well, okay, I have to do it the way that my chef wants me to do it. I have to do it the way that New York wants me to do it. I have to do it the way that you know, is best for this business. So for me, you know, when I finally got to do my own things, or cook at home, actually, I got to just kind of, you know, let my wings open up a little bit and do what I needed to do. Yeah, it was tough, you know. I mean, you know, nothing can prepare you for cooking in a restaurant except for cooking in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I could have gone to school in Italy for 20 years and come back and still get my butt handed
but,
to me.
Now, are they slower in the kitchen, or are they less profit-driven, or
it's more, you know, if you think about it, when I was there, it was more of a, you know what, we're going to cook these 5 things for lunch or for dinner, and that's what we're going to have today. And everyone that comes in is going to want some variant of this, and that'll be great. You know, whereas here, you know, you can have up to 100 menu items sometimes, and, you know, it's just mind-boggling.
Because you got to please everybody.
You absolutely have to please everyone. You have to please the people who, you know, are vegan. You have to please the people who are vegetarian. You have to appease the people who don't eat gluten but are vegetarian and mm-hmm. don't, you know, there's it's a Rubik's Cube of everything. And then there's people who just, you know, absolutely will eat anything out there.
Yeah.
So...
Now, is there more competition here for restaurants? Because, I mean, basically, I think more people eat at home in Italy. So maybe are there fewer restaurants? And it's like a grandmother just being like, we're making the tagliatin with pork sausage.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, that's it.
You know, I mean, here, I mean, anyone who's lived in New York can look at their kitchen and just kind of like shrug and say, there's no way I'm going to cook anything in here. You know, I store my books in my oven, or, you know, my microwave is where I keep my bread, or, you know, I mean, people don't cook here. So, in Italy, you know, people did. People do cook there. And, you know, whether it's just a very simple, you know, spaghetti al pomodoro, that's what they are, what, that's what they're doing. Mm. Here, I mean, gosh, I mean, seamless.com, you think about something like that, these guys have to be making tons and tons of money just because, I mean,
people go out 2-3 nights a week. I mean, or more.
I order in maybe 6 times a week, you know. Yeah.
That's so funny. Well, now tell me about your beginnings a little bit. So Houston, in fact, I was surprised you talked about, I figured you would write Mexican, but Italian, Vietnamese, Cajun. I mean, that was all happening down in Houston when you were in, what was that, the 90s?
I mean, I probably moved to Houston in the mid 80s, and okay. I left there around 2000 and maybe two.
So that was all going on down there, huh?
Oh, it's always been going on. You know, Houston's the fourth largest city in the United States, and it doesn't really, I'm not going to say it doesn't get, you know, the attention that it deserves, but, you know, if you think about it, probably other than Colorado, it has the highest concentration of geologists and engineers and mathematicians. It's petroleum. It's oil.
I see. Right, right, right.
There's a lot of money in Houston. And it's the biggest city coming up from Mexico going toward the East Coast. So, you know, any kind of immigrant population who traditionally took the, you know, coming up through Texas, going up to the east, coming up to New York route, stopped in Texas. I mean, I've yet to see an El Salvadorian restaurant in New York City.
But you do have in Houston.
Tons. I mean, I've had the best pupusas ever.
Interesting. And I think when Katrina hit New Orleans, a lot of those people were moved to Houston, right?
Right, they were.
So there is a real cross-cultural... now, would you say the food is as good there? I mean, as the Italian food, for instance, like you would eat here in New York or in Italy?
Well, you know, in Houston, going back to Houston in like the years that I've been here, they're not doing the Italian food that we're doing here. You know, if...
More red tablecloth, kind of just like pasta with tomato sauce.
Yeah, that type of thing. You know, things that are safe, things that are, you know, staples and things that are good. You know, the veal parmigiano or the, you know, scallopini and stuff like that. And you know what? And they're all great and they're all delicious. But, you know, here, we can't do that. I mean, you can't have four restaurants in you know, on a block all doing the kind of the same thing. And it's just not going to, we have to set ourselves apart here. So, you know, you're going to see, you know, hand-cut egg pasta with saffron and uni and, you know, and cuttlefish or something like that. It's just going to, you know, we have to push it a little bit more here.
So you push it. I mean, Corsino pushes it, but it also stays true because you have prosciutto and bruschetta and all that.
Right,
so
we've got
a tough line to draw because you got to stay tradition, but you got to push the envelope.
Right. You know, the last thing we want to do is scare everyone away by, you know, putting a fried tripe salad on or something like that. But we've got this tripe soup it's amazing. The people who love it will come back for it.
Right.
The people who don't like it, you know, they just won't get it.
Right. Well, let's do a little bit of rapid fire. So sure. We're just going to mention a few places that have been part of your past, and then we're going to talk about the present and then Italian cuisine and eating horse meat and stuff. But let's do this rapid fire because it gets juices flowing. So, this is just off the cuff, couple sentences that you think. Florence, Italy.
Smelled like horses. It changed my life. it was probably the best experience of my life.
Wow. And the Apicius International School of Hospitality, would you recommend students go there? What was your experience?
Absolutely. You know, and they come back and do James Beard dinners once a year. And they have and it's expanded from, you know, just a cooking school to a hospitality school to a design school. And Gabriella Gannucci, the president, she's just one of the smartest business people out there. I mean, she's built this empire of schools and education, and it's basically it's made for people who want to go over there and really immerse themselves in something. So it's Apicius is a great school.
And then just to mention the other one, the Hotel Relais.
Hotel Relais Santa Croce. So this was a hotel above the restaurant in Oteca Pinciori.
Oh, wow.
It was in an old Pope's old palazzo. So there was a dining room in the old music room with these tapestries. And it was gold and beautiful. We did really kind of molecular-ish gastronomy. I mean, I know everyone hates that word now, but that's what we were doing, and it was more like of a lab and stuff. So it was this cool juxtaposition of really modern food and just this ancient, I mean, not ancient, but this very Baroque atmosphere.
So Ferran Adrià or Wiley or that dude in Chicago.
Right, you know, burrata soup with smoked eel and lavender mist, you know, that type of, you know.
That's part of it. I always remember Carlo Pacini, the founder of Slow Food. He went to Il Bulli, Ferran Adrià's famous place in Spain. This was in like 1998, 1999, and he was like, I'm going to hate it, and this is bullshit, that's not food. And he came back totally converted, and he was just like, this is, it's like the haute couture of food. It's not what everyone eats every day, but it's certainly, you know, moving the entire culture of food up a notch.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful stuff.
So now we'll play some American things, and you move back to America. So Portland, Oregon.
It's a fun place. This place here, Roberta's, reminds me a lot of Portland. It was absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous. I mean, the trees, it was so green.
Even though it rained all the time?
It didn't rain all the time.
Okay.
And that's the thing. And people were like, it rains all the time in Portland. Well, no. I mean, it rains. It definitely rains, but not all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can get around Portland 363 days of the year without even having an umbrella. And if you carry an umbrella, they're probably going to make fun of you anyway. So
why? Because it doesn't rain that intently?
Nah, just, you know, tourist. You know, it's a real
FU
type of place sometimes. But
and food-wise?
Food-wise, it was great. Food-wise, it's an amazing place because people are doing... They're doing things the right way in terms of, you know, taking something that the public is not really used to and just blowing it up and going everywhere. So, like, you know, a blade steak at one place turns into a blade steak at 15 other places, and they're all doing it differently, and every chef is kind of riffing on it and doing their thing, you know.
Because it's a tight community there, those chefs.
It's a super tight community. It's a super tight community. And, you know, they all know each other. They've all worked at the same places growing up in Portland. So, you know, five of the top chefs of Portland all work together as line cooks at, you know, wherever, you know, that mm-hmm. type of thing. So they all, they're all friends. They're all, you know, it's a very tight knit.
So tell me about back to New York now. Two restaurants I'll name: Avoce.
Avoce, beautiful food.
That's Andrew Carmelini's restaurant, right?
Actually, it's Missy Robbins.
Oh, that's who you were. It was Andrew, and then
it
wasn't.
Right.
So you worked with Missy.
I worked with Missy and Hillary Sterling, and those two women taught me a lot.
Yeah, what was like one thing that you take with you to the kitchen every day that you learned at Avoce? Is there one thing in particular, or
just be perfect?
Be perfect all the time.
Just work your hardest and be perfect.
Just like Missy. Perfect all the time.
All the time. And Hillary, too. I mean, gosh, that woman, she's an amazing cook.
Tell me about Falai.
Falai. That was fun.
Didn't that start off as a dessert kind of themed
restaurant? So Jacopo Falai was a pastry chef at Enoteca Pincuri in Italy, in Florence. And so... Yeah, he came to New York and I think worked at Le Cirque and some places like that, finally opened his own place. And he started as a pastry place and a bakery. Eventually, he turned the restaurant Falai into a higher-end type of Italian place. He hired a chef, Mauro Buffo, who worked at El Bulli, actually. So we were doing a lot of that type of thing. Mm. And it was... That's quintessential New York. Beautiful, beautiful, gorgeous, awesome food in the tiniest little kitchen that you can ever imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, some of you walk in there, you're like, there's no way I can do this. And you're just, you know, you gotta.
Yeah.
You gotta do it.
Come strong or don't come at all. Hard bodies. That's what the Mama Fuco people say. Are you a hard body?
Right.
So very, very fascinating. Well, we're going to take a very brief break and then come back, talk about Italian cuisine, listening to jazz in the kitchen, and horses and goats. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This song's called Kill Me in the Summertime by Dead Stars on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com. Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Cooking
issues! Who am I fooling? This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die.
It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org.
Well, we are back broadcasting. We have Tomas Curry and we have Alan Benton. Tomas Curry, and then we have Alan Benton coming on. Hey, Joe, did you connect with Alan?
Sure did.
Oh, nice. So very interesting guy. One of the nicest guys in the industry. He'll be on our next segment. But we are in studio with Tomas, and we're having very interesting conversations about his past. So now talking about his present at Corsino. And by the way, I love that Sam Edwards has sponsored it because he makes American prosciutto. But Corsino kind of is, you know, the other side of it, which is importing the best that Italy has to offer. Although you're kind of mixing that up a little bit. You're using a lot of domestic things. For instance, my wife's cheese company, Saxoby Cheesemongers, I know you've gone away from right. Italian cheeses, which is almost unheard of.
Right. We don't have any Italian cheese
so
on.
So interesting.
Yeah. And actually, we had Parmigiano on, and I was like, well, you know what? Like, I know it's good, but we're just going to go all American.
So we interesting. Go. How did Jason react to that and to the clients? I mean, they're like, oh, I want... Gorgonzola. What do you have?
We have used blue. You know, we there's a way to get every flavor profile of cheese, if you want to call it. You know, we can do anything mm-hmm. with what Ann Saxelby has. So I mean, you know, why not?
So now, Brian, you were saying some interesting things in our pre-talk about Italian food. I mean, it's basically. Can be anything, no matter where you are in the world. So explain your philosophy of how Italian cuisine is defined.
Right. I mean, most people might think of Italian food as, you know, a lot of tomato, a lot of basil, you know, throw some eggplant in there and, you know, whatever. But it's so much richer than that. Italian food is about a people who have been bombarded with every culture but their own for the last millennia, and they're just, you know, they just have made the the best of what's around, you know?
It's a little peninsula down the heart of the Mediterranean, so right. There's almost not a culture that has not gone through oh, there, man. From Chinese to
everything.
Moors.
Everything, right. You know, the Anjous are in, where was it? Was it Basilicata or Campania? The Moors were in Sicily. I mean, it's North Africa. I mean, there's so many things about Italy that you would look at and you say, you know what, that's not Italian.
Yeah. My ex-father-in-law, from my first marriage, he was from Sicily, and they called him Il Cinese because he had the squinted eyes, right. And because Chinese people had been through there too, you
right.
know, very funny. And you have a lot of blonde-haired, blue-eyed people.
Up in the north, right. I mean, you go to, I was in Murano for the wine festival there, and people didn't speak Italian. You know, they spoke German,
yeah.
And or variant of that. And you know, you'd go in. I'd go in and get in the morning to a little cafe, try to get a coffee, and I could get my coffee. But then there was like three old guys drinking cold white wine. You know, in these little wine glasses. You know, all the way up to the top, and that was their morning. And, you know, so I was like, man, you know what, these guys aren't speaking Italian. They're not drinking coffee and having cornetti like Italians.
Yes,
like
that's
they're,
so funny.
But they're Italian, you know, and that's, you know, because 60 years ago, that wasn't Italy. That part of Italy wasn't Italy.
I mean, Italy was a political decision. I mean, the dialects spoken from one region to another, the food differences. So, I mean, is there anything that is not Italian? I mean, so you come to America and you have tomatoes from New Jersey, you have apples from upstate New York, so
right.
That's Italian, right?
Of course it's Italian.
It's about taking anything that's fresh and making the most of it.
Right.
Does anything not fall into that?
Maybe rice noodles?
You know? right. But that's still a pasta.
Tortillas,
right.
Tortillas, but that goes downstairs for family meal.
Now, you do like to mix it up. Like, I know for No Goat Left Behind, our goat project, you were like, I don't know, they don't really eat goat in Italy that I'm aware of. And then you did some research and found that they do indeed eat goat in Molise.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, in Molise.
Molise.
Here's the thing about Italy. They eat everything.
Yeah.
Eat everything. It's out there, you know. If it's there, they'll eat it. And it's probably really good too.
Yeah,
you know,
do a damn good job with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so delicious. So, you know, I did this kind of riff on the. It's called Capra Molisana. It's just this like it's a goat stew,
mm-hmm.
And it sold pretty well.
Yeah, well,
it's goat,
it is,
you know,
great to have you buying that. And I love getting that call more than any other. Where you're like, I know I said no to this, but damn it, we're going to do it.
And then now, next week I need two more goats.
Yeah, exactly. I need more goats.
I'm out.
Now, what about horse? Did you eat that in Italy? And
yes.
How come that isn't... well, I know why it's not eaten here, but do you think the taste would be successful and popular if it could be?
Yeah, I mean, it's delicious.
Is
it's
it?
Delicious.
Isn't
it's
it
so
too
good.
Lean and gamey?
So or? Lean. It's not that gamey, but it's a little sweet. I mean,
okay.
You know, I mean, if I go out and have a steak, I'm probably going to have a ribeye.
Right.
Because it tastes amazing. I would never go out and pay money for a filet mignon, but there are people who will go out and pay triple the price for something that's, you know, like a filet mignon. You could put horse in front of them, and they would absolutely love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would they taste the difference?
They might,
uh-huh.
But they might not.
You Interesting.
Know? It's so good. It's sweeter. It's kind of like it's a little wetter.
Okay.
Then beef is.
Interesting. I mean, you know, it's a real tragedy. You know, PETA and all these environmental, you know, humane, they're not even about humane animal welfare, but they thought, well, if we want to be good to horses, we have to eliminate every slaughterhouse in America, which they did successfully. And of course, you know, you shouldn't always hope what you wish for, because the opposite happened. Now you have horses starving, people not knowing how to process them and give them a dignified end to their lives.
Right.
And, you know, they're starving to death in fields. And the fact that horses cannot be eaten, the fact that, you know, we can't use them for pet food, you know, actually it's the reverse effect. More horses are suffering because of it. So
right.
To say that we should be raising horses as food, but...
Right. You know, and you know, no one in Italy raises a horse for food.
Yeah, but they give it a day. What better dignified end than consuming the animal you've loved so much?
The greatest gift of all.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in the spirit of messing around with so many different types of ingredients, which, you know, Italian food lends itself to, you like listening to jazz in the kitchen. That's interesting.
I do.
Explain what you listen to and why that is.
So kind of recently, it's probably been the complete In a Silent Way sessions from Miles Davis. So okay. we all know the album In a Silent Way, but there's the complete studio sessions that were in there. I mean, there's stuff that, man, it's mind blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And jazz is kind of like food because, you know, you have to start with basics. You have to know your scales. You have to know, you know, you have to read music, but then you just open it up and go anywhere you want, you know, and you go from something like, the bebop era or something like that, where it was just, you know, going up and down scales, and then Miles Davis turned it upside down, and he's like, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to do something called modal jazz. We're using fourths and fifths and you know, these circles of notes and how they all kind of, like, relate to each other and within like, keys. And it's just like, wow, I mean, we kind of do that with food too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, gosh, like, you think of something like pork belly, mm-hmm. right? That was, you know, just basically like a commodity. It was something that people, you know, didn't really even care about other than it being bacon.
Right.
But now, I mean, if I see pork belly on a menu, I'm probably going to get it, you know, just to see what's happening.
Yeah.
Just to see what's going on. And so, you know, tripe. I mean, gosh.
Tell us the cuts that go into tripe. For people hear tripe all the time, but you're talking about stomach lining.
So it's I think the second ruminant stomach of we use veal, and so it's veal honeycomb tripe, and so in Texas, in Houston, I grew up eating that Mexican soup called menudo.
Hmm.
Supposed to be like this amazing hangover, you know, cure, blah, 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 blah. You squeeze like a bunch of lime and then raw onion on the top. I mean, gosh, I've yet to find a good menudo here. We'll see how it goes. But every time I go back to Houston, I get it. It's great. I grew up on it. It's great. It has hominy in it. Oh, man, just forget about it. It's great.
Huh.
So, you know, using something like tripe, I think it's like my responsibility to use stuff like that. You know, mm-hmm. I have to because...
You got to push the envelope, push no,
like, ingredients. Like, who else is going to use it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, right. That's true.
Who else is? You know, and
chefs drive economies
right.
and culture, yeah.
And people have to eat what, you know, what they want to eat, and they will. And the people who don't eat the tripe won't eat the tripe. But I've got two tripe dishes on my menu right now, and they're both pretty good.
Two tripe dishes. Yeah. I love it. Now, I take it when Hugo Boss hired you and Denton Catering, tripe was on the top of their list. No, just kidding. But talk about this. I didn't know Jason had a catering thing, but that is cool that you're doing this long-term catering thing, although you don't really view it as catering.
No, it's not. It's not catered food. It's not triangle sandwiches and, you know...
craft table.
Gosh, no, not at all. I mean, we don't even have, you know, the chafers or steam dishes or anything like that. It's all fresh. We do it, you know, we prep the food at Corsino. I get there at 5 in the morning, get everything ready, you know, ship, you know, we truck it over to Hugo Boss, get set up for breakfast, fresh pastries, fresh muffins, jams, frittata every day, you know. And so in these people and Hugo Boss is like really getting a good menu. And what happens is I take all the stuff there and then, you know, get everything set up for breakfast. And during that time, I'm prepping for lunch because everything that I'm doing is done probably about an hour before.
Mm-hmm.
It's served, so like, you know, that tomato sauce that's going into the pasta and that grated cheese, all that stuff has been made there on site. On
that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's I'm turning that place into my kitchen.
Uh-huh, that is amazing. Now, is your food healthy? I mean, you say that you work, I know you're a marathon runner, you've worked with a nutritionist in the past, but I've never heard a restaurateur or none of the ones I've, you know, chef be like, oh no, my food's super healthy. But you push that envelope a little bit.
I do. Cause like, I mean, I'd like to live to be a, you know, a healthy, you know, 70-year-old. I mean, and I think we all do, you know,
You're cooking prosciutto and pasta with cream sauce and stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, no, there's no cream.
No, not cream, but yeah, you know what I mean.
But, and people will eat that if they want to eat that. But, you know, something that I want, I have to have options on my menu for the people who want, you know, to hit that, you know, just pork ragu and, which is actually your pork.
Oh, thank you.
And tagliatelle, you know, with cheese. And people love that. People adore that pasta. Mm-hmm. But then I also have to have something on there that's, you know, that someone might not want. So kind of like, we have a farrotto dish. So it's farro, mm-hmm, cooked like a risotto with, black Tuscan kale, squash, throw some radicchio in there. A little bit of lemon to like give it some life, and then it's finished off with shaved grana padano and some vin cotto, and it's great. It's delicious, and it's one of my favorite things to eat because, number one, it's vegetarian. If you don't put the cheese on it, it's vegan, and it eats like a meal. So someone can come in who is vegan and say, "Hey, I'm vegan. What can I get?" And they're not going to sit at my restaurant while everyone else is eating, you know, the flatbread, and they're eating, you know, pasta or a steak and like all that stuff, and they're stuck where they're there with a salad. That's not how to treat people.
Yeah, no, for sure. In fact, I am always a big fan of pushing vegetarians to go to restaurants that have great vegetarian offerings, mm-hmm, versus a vegetarian restaurants, which doesn't imply a particular cuisine or talent. And a lot of the time, you know, you have pan flutes playing on the music, but you don't have, you know, great food.
I mean, when I was in Portland, there were quite a bit of vegetarian restaurants, and man, it was crazy how these people stretched whatever that they were doing to approximate meat. And it's like, you know what, man, if your body wants meat, you should probably give it meat. But if you want to eat vegetarian, like, love the vegetables that you're eating. Like, love how meaty, like, a really good sautéed carrot can be.
Yeah, exactly. For sure, for sure. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating interview. I mean, we could have, there were about 10 questions on my list, which we did not get to. So
maybe next time.
Yeah, you got to come back and come back on panels, come back with Jason Denton. I didn't even ask, you know, he was one of our first buyers when he was an owner at Lupa. So, well, I hope you sit in for our next segment with Alan Benton. But we're going to go from, you know, who knows, maybe Alan Benton's making Italian food, Tomas, by your definition of Italian food.
I promise you he is.
Yes. Well, as Joe calls Alan, who is one of the most important ham curers, which is a very American tradition, unlike in Italy, it goes through a smoking process. A lot of hams are salty, you know, here because they're not aged quite as long. But now people like Alan and Sam Edwards and Nancy Newsom, among a few people who are starting to make prosciutto-style hams. And really, I have to say, I would be hard-pressed to think of anyone nicer, more generous, more patient, more understanding than Alan Benton, who buys our hams and bacons. So let's see. Alan, are you on the phone with us?
I'm on the phone with you, certainly.
Oh, well, it's great to have you on. I know this is a big Sunday with your family, so thanks so much for giving us a few minutes on Heritage Radio today.
Patrick, I'm delighted for the opportunity to talk with you today.
What a guy. So you were in, is it Maryville, Tennessee? Is that where your curing facility is?
It's actually 20 miles south of Maryville, Tennessee, a little town called Madisonville.
Madisonville.
Population around 4,000, Patrick.
Oh, wow. And is that where you and your family are from for a few generations, or did you move there from somewhere else?
I was actually born in Scott County, Virginia, about 3 hours from here. My grandparents lived, both sides of the family lived about a mile apart. They had actually homesteaded adjoining sections there in Scott County. Very mountainous, remote area.
And was there a curing tradition there to begin with? And where did that come? How did that come to be a tradition?
Patrick, what I do it was sustenance food for poor Southerners. In the mountainous region that we were from, it wasn't practical to try to raise cattle. It was very, very remote. My grandparents didn't have the ability to raise a lot of the feed that necessary for larger animals, and hogs were cheap and easy to produce. Mm-hmm. It was also very easy to preserve. Both sides of the family had smokehouses. I still have our own home place in Virginia. The old log smokehouse sits 10 feet out the back door behind the house I was born in. Mm-hmm. And actually, the aged hams that I make, I'm using the original family recipe straight from that log smokehouse, and I'm probably making my hams no better than my grandparents or most of their neighbors made it. And I am very thankful and count my blessings daily that people like what we're doing. I hope that my grandparents would be proud of what I'm doing now. We, not having grain to feed these pigs, to get back to your question, this was something that was done there. They would turn their hogs loose in the mountains along about August each year because they would run out of feed to feed them, and extra produce from the gardens was not available at that time. So they would simply turn the hogs loose in the mountains to forage for whatever they could find, acorns or whatever it was. And the quality of pork that they produced was absolutely extraordinary.
Now, how did the pigs find their way back to the house?
Patrick, it was so easy. I was addressing a group of entrepreneurs at the University of Tennessee many years ago, and a lady frantically kept waving her hand, and she said, "Mr. Benton, it seems that these hogs would go feral. How did you possibly manage to round them up?" It was so easy, Patrick. They were accustomed to being fed by my grandparents. They would usually have a metal bucket that they would throw the corn in. All my grandparents had to do was take that old metal bucket, throw a few ears of corn in it, walk back into the hills, and rattle that bucket a few times. Those pigs would come running like a bunch of starved puppies, and they would follow. They would follow them right back into the hog lot where we had raised them. It was extraordinary pork, and I have to tell you, my first trip to New York was when I really figured out the difference between the pork I was making and the pork my grandparents made, because I had tried to duplicate the quality. I didn't know if it was the breed of the pigs, what they were fed. I couldn't put it together. And I have a friend there in New York named Peter Kaminsky. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Oh, yeah, the author of Pig Perfect.
Pig Perfect. Well, I got to sit on a panel with he and a few other culinary heavyweights. I was the only good old boy on that panel, I can tell you. And I was mesmerized by what Peter had to say, because I was just buying basically feedlot pork and trying to turn it into something extraordinary, and I was doing my best. I was aging these hams for a couple of years and trying my best to make quality pork. But when he started talking about how they raise these pigs in that Iberian Peninsula, Spain, and they fatten them on acorns, the light bulb went off, even for a dumb hillbilly like me. And I came back from that trip to New York bent on finding better quality pork. And I've told Peter many times what an impact he made on me.
Oh, that's tremendous.
And that's one of the reasons I'm doing business with you now, because I'm searching for that great pork, of course.
Well, I think you transformed that product so much. I mean, this is a huge tradition from your grandparents to, you know, one of the few, most popular foods of the South. I mean, is this a pressure for you, Alan, to be constantly carrying on this art form? And I know there are a lot fewer cures today than they were back in your grandparents' day. Do you find this a pressure ever to maintain quality and keep this hard work up?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as pressure, Patrick, but it's a challenge. When I went into country ham business 40 years ago, I made my mind up. I wrote to universities all over the South, writing to experts anywhere in the world I could think to write, trying to learn more about what I wanted to do. Because if I was going to make ham and bacon, I wanted to make extraordinary ham and bacon. That was my goal. And I sure won't tell you that we've achieved that goal, but I can promise you in my business, I strive toward that every day. The challenge today is to find employees, and I only have a dozen employees, but the challenge is to find people who will dedicate themselves and buy into your philosophy to help you make a world-class product. I want people that take pride and want to help produce the best bacon or the best ham that we know how to make. And that's the biggest challenge. The younger employees today sometimes don't have the same work ethic or the same philosophy that some of the older employees have. I have one employee, Arthur Atkins, who has worked for me for 40 years. He's 77 years old. He still comes to work, and he takes great pride in wanting to produce a world-class product.
Well, you hired him smart, because his last name is Atkins. So he likes. Give me an example, real quick, of a corner that gets cut by a new employee that somebody like you would not cut. Is it the way they pull it out of the smokehouse, the amount of time they do some aspect of it? If you could break down the grammar of that a little bit for us, what does it mean to cut corners in the art of ham and bacon curing?
Patrick, when I hire a new employee, what I do is pretty unusual in today's world. This is a throwback to another era. And I want people, I know they're going to be a blank slate, basically, when it comes to my business. But I want people that will do not almost what I'm saying to do, but exactly what I'm saying to do. Because quality is the bottom line in my business. It doesn't matter. Sometimes I pay so much for pork that I know I'm probably not going to make a profit on it. But that's okay, because the bottom line has to be the quality. We want to make something as good as the Europeans are making it. Anybody in the world is making it. That's our goal. And as I said a while ago, I sure wouldn't tell you that we're doing that, but I can promise you, every day in my business, that's what I strive to produce, because we're so lucky that people like what I'm doing. This is this was just sustenance food for Southerners, and how lucky I am that great chefs in this country, with their ingenuity and their talent, can use my product and highlight it and make it something incredible.
Well, I mean, your Benton is a household name amongst foodies. I mean, certainly here in New York, and I love the way chefs are smart enough. These are the nation's greatest tastemakers. They're smart enough to know when someone else can do it better. I know with making ramen, for instance, sometimes you have to delegate that, or great cured hams and bacon. What is the aspect of what you do, Alan, that's taken the longest to perfect? I mean, are there certain tastes, or, you know, what is the greatest challenge of your work? Or, you know, you say, oh, I'm still not perfect. What is that? Is it just that it's the being able to duplicate the same taste every single time? Is it the amount of smoke you give it? What is that kind of magic dust that you feel that you have not 100% mastered yet, even after 40 years?
Well, Patrick, it's odd that you ask, but you can take a rack of hams that are 21 months old, and you can choose two hams hanging side by side, and there will be subtle differences, and I wish I knew what to attribute those differences to. After 40 years, I still can't pinpoint it. The salting of the meat is, applying the cure is critical. You want to get exactly the right proportions. And each step of the process, if it's not done precisely like you want it done, it can turn out to not be the quality you're looking for. And to achieve that, when I first started in this business, I rubbed every piece of meat myself. I did everything myself. And it was much easier to control the quality because I was so dedicated to making a world-class product. I didn't want to make a lot of ham or a lot of bacon. I wanted to make extraordinary ham and extraordinary bacon. And this philosophy is still with us today. I choose not to crank up and make a lot of bacon or a lot of ham. I still want to make high quality and focus on that, and count my blessings that people like what we're doing.
Well, I want to, you know, thank you so much for being on. I mean, there's many people in the food world that I like very much and some that I love. To Alan, I would be able, one of the few people I'm able to add, I have a tremendous amount of respect for. Every time I talk to you, every time I hear you speak, or, you know, I read about you speaking in various places. So it is an honor to work with you, and it's an honor to have you on the station. And I hope that we can do a few more interviews like this throughout this year, because people in the food movement stand to learn a lot from what you do.
Well, Patrick, I'm excited for the opportunity to talk with you, and I'm equally excited that I'm able to buy your pork, because it has a lot to do. You can only make something really good if you start out with something really good. Any great chef will tell you that. And for my business, it's critical that I'm able to buy top quality pork, and you're certainly one of my best suppliers. And thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the Super Bowl. Who do you pick, Ravens or the Niners?
You know, I have to tell you, I'm not a huge pro football fan, but when I follow it, I'm a Tennessee alumnus. Peyton Manning has got my heart in Denver right now.
Oh.
My team is not playing, but I'll just watch and enjoy anyway, Patrick.
All right, my friend. Well, have a great weekend, and I will talk to you very soon. And thanks for listening, everybody. Tomas, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Joe Galarraga, thank you for engineering and producing the show today. Next week, we will be back with Egg and Parrish Hall, the chefs, and also Mario Fantasma, the owner of Paradise Locker Meats, where we do all our processing. So stay tuned for Straight No Chaser. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.